The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Noah, I wanted you to be part of this week's introduction to the Zero Squared podcast. It's a little different than in weeks past. Well, this was a recording of a presentation I gave at the PNCA, which is the Pacific Northwest College of Art, rather than an interview with a Zero Books author or other author.
Well, that is quite lovely.
Who are you trying to be, saying that's quite lovely?
It is a matter of your opinion.
In any case, I gave a presentation on Marx's critique of the Gotha program and Theodore Adorno's culture industry chapter from his book Negative Dialectics.
Ah, well, that is quite nice.
Do you know who Theodore Adorno was?
Not exactly.
What is this accent that you're doing? All right, well, it's Wednesday, March 16th, 2016, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast.
Yes, you are. Why are you acknowledging that?
Well, because I'm telling people who are listening. The music you're listening to right now is Dan Letts, Yeah, It's All Right.
Oh, yes. But it is all right.
Yeah, that's the music.
Well, that's quite nice.
But in just a moment, you'll be listening to me talk about Karl Marx's Gotha Program, critique of the Gotha Program, and Theodore Adorno.
Oh, how lovely.
What I asked you to look at was Marx's critique of the Gotha Program and the chapter on the culture industry from Negative Dialectics. What you might notice about these two essays is that they're really asking very different questions. Marx's questions: what do we need to do to create socialism or to get out from underneath capitalism? And Adorno's question is different. He's asking about the Enlightenment. He's critiquing something maybe a bit larger than what Marx is taking on when he critiques capitalism. Adorno is perhaps a little more philosophical in some ways. The critique of the Gotha Program was a critique of the conference that was aimed to unify the German Social Democratic Party. This guy here is LaSalle, and he had his own economic ideas. And the party was a reformist party calling for suffrage, the freedom to associate, limits on the working day, and so on. But it deemed itself to be a revolutionary and socialist party. And Karl Marx was very critical of their program and their self-regard. And that comes out in his essay on the critique of the Gotha Program, which he didn't publish at the time. Some of the big issues right at the start of the Gotha Program have to do with how we should conceive of wealth and society and the source of wealth. At the very beginning, Marx quotes the Gotha Program. There's a line that says, all wealth comes from human labor. And Marx maybe counterintuitively takes issue with that. He wants to point out that human labor is not a magical force that produces the world, but that, in fact, human labor relates to nature, and that the primary source of wealth is nature. The reason he wants to point that out is not because he's a naturalist or has a great love of nature, but because he wants to underline the property relation that sets up the class society he wants to overcome. So it's not human labor alone that creates wealth, but human labor as it interacts and mediates and shapes the natural world, and that mediation, the power to act upon the world, is constrained by property relations. So that's important for Marx. He wants to point that out, that if you say that human labor is free from the start and you ignore property relations, you're missing the boat. But the important thing to point out here is that Marx sees human beings as separate from nature. He doesn't believe that we can have a direct, unmediated experience of nature, or that our labor can be performed in nature and in an indirect way. He's a critic of Rousseau, and he wants to point out that our relationship to wealth, our relationship to the natural world, is always going to be based on our social relations. And if our social relations are contradictory and are founded on inequality, then, you know, so will the wealth of society, so will our lived experience be contradictory and founded on inequality. Another issue that's raised in the Critique of the Gotha program is the difference between use values and social needs. And this may seem very different than the question about the source of wealth, but it isn't fundamentally different. LaSalle has this idea that every worker should have access to, basically that since all labor, this is what he says. He says, since all labor is social labor, that in a society, the only wealth-producing labor that can exist would be social labor. Therefore, all the products of our human labor should be collectively owned by society. And what Marx wants to point out is that societies are different. And what is fair distribution in one society is going to be different than what's considered fair in another. That the idea of fair distribution is perfectly acceptable to our bourgeois enemies, because for them, fair distribution is takes place in the market. You go in the market with your money and pay what something is actually worth and take it home. That's fair. And so what's needed is not to turn over the products of human labor to society, but to change society. Again, the point is that for Marx, there is a human subject. There's a human subject individually. There's a human subject collectively. I put Descartes up here because, again, for Marx, there is a split between the natural world and the social one, or the human one. And for Marx, the goal is to change that social realm. And so here we have, again, just another reiteration of the difference between labor as a living natural force and labor as a social construction, labor as a social relation. So this here is abstract labor value, dollar bill, and it's that is how labor appears socially in the world, according to Marx. And what's important here to point out is that Marx's theory of how capitalism works really relies on this distinction between living labor and what he calls labor power. It's not just an important difference, you know, in so much as it preserves a subject, although it is interesting to point out that at this point the subject, the social subject, would be an object, would be the dollar bill, according to Marx, which is, you know, our social relationships become objects that mediate the world for us, according to Marx. It's also important, just in terms of economics, the worker, in order to be exploited, doesn't sell his living labor. to the boss. He sells his labor power. And his labor power is an actual commodity, or it's really a basket of commodities. His labor power is a basket of commodities he needs in order to reproduce himself, in order to be able to survive. So if you're a Portlander, your labor power is going to be equal to the price of probably a Pabst Blue Ribbon, a slice of pizza, you know, day's worth of rent, a little hashish, and some bicycle repair kit. That's your labor power. It has nothing really to do with your actual living labor. You're exchanging your work, your living labor, but you're actually not exchanging. You're exchanging your labor power, your promise to work, for these basket of commodities, and your living labor is being exploited.
Money can really fuck you up. It can make you lose your home. It can make you go to work. It can topple governments, cause wars, pave the jungles. Of course, it's really nothing by itself. Pieces of paper, digits in a computer. And of course, money doesn't literally take away homes, topple governments, cause wars, or fuck you up. People do these things. Money, then, seems to have a strange power to compel people to do things. It has a certain social power. What kind of social power does money have? It seems to have any social power we might want it to have. In a society in which social life is coordinated by market exchange, money has the ability to buy any aspect of this social life, to compel any action, to coordinate any complex activity. The more money we have, the greater our ability to command this social power. This is a non-specific power. It is not tied to any particular activity, commodity, or person. It is social power in the abstract. This is not social power in the form of guns or tanks. It is social power in the form of these strange tokens of value used to measure the quantitative relations between commodities. This abstract social power goes by another name, value. The subordination of society to the rule of value we call the law of value. In other times and places, social power took the form of a sword. It was direct, concrete. But value is not like this. It is abstract. We do not know where it comes from or where it's going. It does not come from the 1%. It does not come from the Fed. It comes from a specific organization of society. What sort of organization of society is necessary for the existence of this value in the abstract? This is not just an academic question. This question gets to the heart of how we understand capitalism and how we envision alternatives to capitalism. Oftentimes, we hear quite different recipes for ending the rule of capital. Abolishing private property, ending wage labor, capturing the state, smashing the state, democratizing money, ending money, and so on. There are many different facets, many different interpenetrating parts of the dense tapestry of interrelations that make up a capitalist society, and they all bear the mark of the dominance of value relations over our lives. How we understand the relation of the parts to the whole affects how we understand an anti-capitalist project. So, when we ask what sort of organization of society is necessary for the existence of this value in the abstract, we are setting the stage for an exploration of the interrelations of capitalist society. Bourgeois theory tends to restrict its view to the marketplace. This is why it always refers to capitalism as a free market society or a free enterprise system, rather than a wage labor society or a production for the sake of production system. From this narrow viewpoint, we only see freely consenting individuals making mutually beneficial exchanges. From this viewpoint, it seems that value is nothing else than a benign byproduct of mutual agreements between market actors. The benign nature of this viewpoint influences not only mutualist anarchists, but also some socialists who want to preserve some element of market exchange in their anti-capitalist vision. But this narrow picture of exchange is not adequate to actually explain the phenomenon of value in the abstract. When two Robinson Crusoes meet in the desert to trade, their exchanges are not abstract at all. They are related to very concrete personal desires. It is quite another thing in a society organized through exchange where we can observe regular, predictable exchange ratios between commodities. In order for us to form predictable, reliable exchange ratios between things, there must be some predictable knowledge of the quantity of things we have to exchange, how much we will have tomorrow, and so on. We must have some predictable supply. The force that constantly replenishes these supplies is, of course, human labor. This brings us to a fuller picture of our society ruled by abstractions. Rather than just a society of free exchange, it is also a society in which this exchange is regulated by production. The production of commodities by people creates both the demand for and supply of these commodities. The exchange ratios between commodities, their values, are signals which coordinate the social labor process. Thus, we have a society in which exchange and production constantly regulate each other. Behind the movement of commodity values in the market lies a parallel process of the movement of labor from one task to another. The social power of money, of value, lies in its ability to move about this labor. If the abstract social power of money comes from its ability to measure and command labor, what kind of labor is this labor? Knitting? Building? Singing? It's any kind of labor. Labor in general. Abstract labor. We began by asking what sort of society makes the rule of abstractions possible, makes the law of value possible. After penetrating the surface appearance of market exchanges, we found that it is a society in which value relations between commodities are directly related to the labor that produces these commodities. And now we have seen that the abstractness of these value relations is paralleled by the abstract nature of labor. Does this answer our question as to what sort of society makes such abstractions possible? No. Marx is sometimes taken to task for his concept of abstract labor. How is it possible, some ask, for Marx to theoretically equate all of these different sorts of labors, manual and intellectual labor, skilled and unskilled labor? Labor is never abstract, they argue, but it is always a specific type of labor. Marx's reply is typical of Marx. We don't have to theoretically equate all of these different labors. Society does it for us. Society already treats all labor as an abstraction. For us as individuals, our work seems very concrete and very important. But when we suddenly lose our job because of an economic crisis, when we see jobs move to other countries, when we see entire skill sets replaced by machines, we realize that our own livelihood means nothing to capitalism. For capital, our work is just an abstract unit in a giant profit calculator. We are just another digit to be moved around. In this sense, though our work seems very specific and concrete to us, for capitalism, it is completely abstract. All that matters is that it produces value. If abstract labor is not a philosophical idea, but a real phenomenon, a real abstraction that is made by capitalism itself, then that leads us to ask again, what sort of society makes this possible? The answer is this. In order for our labor to become abstract units in the profit calculator of capitalism, capital must own our work. Our working time must be a commodity. A society ruled by the law of value requires wage labor. People are not commodities, but their ability to work is. This is called labor power. We said that the buying and selling of commodities regulates the division of labor, sending signals that apportion labor between different tasks. This can only happen if labor power itself is also a commodity to be bought and sold, moved about. Wage labor is the mechanism by which the hidden hand of the market moves labor inputs about. We finally have an answer that seems adequate to our initial question, what sort of society makes possible the law of value, the subordination of society to the abstraction of value. We see that this abstraction of value is tied to the abstraction of labor. And this abstract labor relies on the existence of labor power as a commodity. When labor power is a commodity, then the specific uses of that labor become irrelevant to capital. All that is important is that profit can be produced by exploiting this labor. It doesn't matter if this labor knits sweaters or makes guns. It doesn't matter if we work 80-hour weeks or work dangerous jobs. It doesn't matter when the mines collapse on us. It doesn't matter when we are replaced by robots or when our jobs move somewhere else. It doesn't matter when unemployment drives down our wages. Our work is just an input into the production of value, of social power. Capital is the expansion of this value, of this social power, for its own sake, not for any particular purpose. Value is a social power because it commands people. It buys their time and commands them to do its bidding. It does this not for the sake of the worker or the consumer. It does this not for the sake of the 99% or the 1%. It does this for the sake of producing value for its own sake. It has no human purpose, though there are some humans that benefit greatly from this process. Yet, our answer to this question still points to other questions. What sort of society is necessary in order for wage labor to be the dominant form of labor? We must have a society in which people don't have access to their own means of production, but instead must sell their labor power in the market in order to survive. This requires private property, a capitalist state to guard this property, and lots of drugs and smooth jazz to keep us passive. This is why, whenever the law of value seems to be breaking down, like in an economic crisis, the state must step in to restore the smooth functioning of value relations. Rather than a simple answer to our question, what sort of organization of society is necessary for the existence of value in the abstract, we have arrived at a complex web of social processes. We haven't found one fundamental evil to be stamped out. Instead, we see that there are many different overlapping dimensions to the question of value. Social power, value relations, class, property relations, and the state are all bound up in our analysis, each reflecting a different aspect of the law of value. So what parts of these interrelating factors need to be gotten rid of if we are to overthrow capital? I would argue that we need to do away with all of it. Value, money, abstract labor, wage labor, capital, private property, the state, and so on. Other folks might take less ambitious positions. Different political positions on this issue come from different ways of understanding the way the interrelations of a capitalist society fit together. For the market socialist vision, it seems that all we need to do is replace the class relationships in the workplace with a cooperative workplace, leaving market exchange intact. But such a cooperative society would still have wage labor, socially necessary labor time, value in the abstract, and abstract labor. Cooperatives would still be compelled by competition to produce surplus value in order to expand production and stay competitive. Production would still be for the sake of producing surplus value, and not for the sake of bettering society. It is probable that the most efficient and successful firms would be those with the least cooperative structure and the highest disciplining of labor. For the 20th century communism of the USSR, it was initially the seizure of state power by a vanguard of the working class, the nationalization of property, internationalism, and the administration of production by a plan that was thought to be sufficient to break with the capitalist mode of production. Yet the plans of the planners soon began to resemble the most despotic plans of the capitalist workplace. In order to compete in the world market,
planners found that they needed to extract the highest amount of surplus value from workers as possible. There was still wage labor, socially necessary labor time, surplus value, and abstract labor. The same year the conveyor belt was introduced to Soviet Russia, they revised their textbooks to claim that the law of value now applied to socialism. This means that if we are to be serious about anti-capitalist politics, we have to be serious about our analysis of capitalism. What is it we are really trying to do away with? And what forms of organization can replace capitalism effectively?
So that was Marx as a YouTube video. And now we'll talk a little bit about, I'll try to make it quick here, about Adorno and an excerpt from Dialectic of Enlightenment. So the end of this video that we just saw sort of covered some ground that is important to think of when you're thinking about Adorno, because he was writing after it was fairly evident what Stalinism was, and you know, after the rise of fascism and Nazis, and after what seemed like a pretty devastating failure for the kinds of socialist projects that Marx had been involved in. But he was still a committed socialist and some sort of Marxist. And he was asking the question, I think, you know, why didn't this work out? Why did this all fail? And why did the working class not revolt in Germany? That was one he was asking. And instead of returning like a good Marxist to Capital and reading through it again, he turned his attention to a larger question, the question of the Enlightenment itself, of which Marx is just one figure. For Adorno, the big idea was to critique the Enlightenment itself. This here is Hugo from comic strip Nancy, although it's been repurposed. This is not the original text. This is a situationist cartoon, Situationist International, where a group of Marxist anarchist types in Paris around the before and during the time of the May strikes, May of 68. And it says, I'm bored. What the public wants is the image of reality, not reality itself. So what I'm going to propose is that a kind of thought entered the left after the failure of the Soviet Union, after World War II, really maybe after World War I, after, you know, pretty early on, but it was certainly after World War II, that the problem was that we had lost our touch with nature or with the real world or with what was authentic. And the project should be some sort of return to the authentic. And Hugo, I think, is expressing that, and I think Adorno does too. The quote here is, knowledge, which is power, knows no limits, either in its enslavement of creation or in its deference to worldly masters. Technology is the essence of this knowledge. It aims to produce neither concepts nor images, nor the joy of understanding, but method, exploitation of the labor of others, capital. So Adorno has made this move where knowledge has become capital, become capitalism. But it's not really true that capital doesn't produce images. Here are two of them that it produced. I asked the question, is it true that the commodities that instrumental reason produce contain no concepts? They do contain a concept. One of them is the concept of abstract labor. Does instrumental reason not produce images? Is method and concept, body and mind, ever truly split? So in some ways, Adorno's critique of the culture industry, which we looked at, parallels Marx's critique of the Gotha program. So what Adorno wants to demonstrate is the ways in which the capitalism influences and determines the way we think, what's created in the realm of leisure and culture. But while Marx emphasizes nature and labor and the difference between the two, Adorno seems to mourn the disappearance of nature. So here's some images here. Again, this is from the film Koikatsi, which is a sequel to Koyaanisqatsi. Have you seen that film? This is from the movie Society of the Spectacle, Guy Debord. I think that's an ad for the Pentium process. So Adorno's complaint is against ideology, style, religion, culture, because they serve the economic system, not because they are ideologies or styles. But he leaves that capitalist system unexamined in his work and aimed at thinking and enlightenment, the false thinking of the Enlightenment instead. And he says that the consumers of the culture industry fall helpless to are helpless victims to the culture industry which capitalism produces. But so it seems to me that Adorno's premise is that capitalist production, the capitalist society, has achieved total domination. Oops. Knocked over my microphone here. But the point is that total domination would, I think, make capitalism back into nature. It would make it something other than our own set of social relations. And it would mean that our consciousness was fixed in a way that consciousness really can never be. And this is a quote from Karl Marx's German Ideology, and I think it emphasizes the need to maintain a split between the subject and the object, or between the mind and matter, without losing sight of the fact that each side of that dialectic relies upon the other. Consciousness can never be anything else than consciousness, a conscious existence, and the existence of men is their actual life process. If in all ideology men and their circumstances appear upside down, as in a camera obscura, this phenomenon arises just as much from their historical life process as the inversion of objects on the retina does from their physical life process. For Marx, the trick was to see the camera. It was to recognize that the world as you see it is appearing upside down, and there is a life process at work. There is a set of social relations. Mm-hmm. And for Karl Marx, the trick was to try to change that social relations, come up with a better camera. I'm not sure that Adorno was optimistic enough to hold that position. And I'm afraid that in the end, he may have ended up erasing the difference between what is a social relationship and what is nature, and which is the very thing I think he really wanted to avoid.
A photographic quarterly, Camera Work, was published by Alfred Stieglitz shortly after the turn of the century. The photographs, drawings, and articles by Stieglitz and his friends signaled photography's coming of age in America. Photography is an art, a step in learning, and an insight into the life and the things that surround us. Stieglitz described his own work as the exploration of the familiar. He said, "I have found my subjects within 60 yards of my door." He favored any means that might free the photographer's whole energies so that they could be channeled in the direction of the decision, the picture itself. Since 1947, Edwin Land and Polaroid have pursued a central concept, one single thread, the removal of the barriers between the photographer and his subject. And now, a compact, folding, electronically controlled, motor-driven, single-lens reflex camera capable of focusing from infinity down to 10 inches.
Capitalist, you know, advertiser for a very fine camera from the 70s had a goal of eliminating that barrier between the photographer and his subject, or from social relationship and the world, to make that camera, that process, as easy and seamless and as invisible as possible. Adorno and Marx would be appalled, both of them. Marx would want to make a camera that we could truly control.